Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, and this is the Friday Roundtable. Today, we're in the NPR Forum with an audience of healthcare experts, graduate students, and others who are interested in health policy. And we're talking about the future of the Affordable Care Act. It's an issue that surfaced at some rather raucous congressional town hall meetings recently, including this one by Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell.
The last I heard, these coal jobs are not coming back, and now these people don't have the insurance they need because they're poor. And they work those coal mines, and they're sick. The veterans are sick. The veterans are broken down. They're not getting what they need. If you can answer any of that, I'll sit down and shut up like Elizabeth Warren.
I don't think Mitch McConnell had a specific answer for that voter. But challenges like that one are precisely the reason that the pressure is really on the Republican majority to deliver on its promise to replace Obamacare with something better. So what have they come up with? We're going to talk about that today. Will it satisfy people who are worried about changes to the ACA? And what will it mean for the cost and quality of health care overall? Those are some of the questions that we're going to tackle today in our forum roundtable. And I'd also like to hear from you on Twitter. Are you one of those voters who didn't like the Affordable Care Act, but who is now deeply worried about what Republicans may replace it with? By the way, you can hear the whole forum discussion on my podcast. You can search for NPR News with Carrie Miller wherever you get your podcast, but you can also weigh in during the conversation. Tweet me at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I, NPR. Dr. Arkel Giorgio is a physician and executive in residence at the Carlson School of Management, and she is the author of Healthcare Choices. First name's good?
Absolutely.
Arkel, welcome. Good to have you here. Dr. Rajiv Shah is a physician and founder of MyMeds. Rajiv, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
And Steve Parente is with us, a health policy expert and chair of the Medical Industry Leadership Institute at the University of Minnesota and a familiar voice on Minnesota Public Radio. Steve, good to see you again.
Good to see you.
Welcome back. President Trump has been promising to repeal Obamacare and replace it with something better for more than a year. He has said at times that they will do it simultaneously. When he was speaking to the Governor's Association, we got the sense that he's figuring out that this may be more difficult than he originally thought, something that President Obama apparently knew. Listen to this.
Now, I have to tell you, it's an unbelievably complex subject. Nobody knew that healthcare could be so complicated.
You know, healthcare is complicated
because our healthcare system is so complex. I suffer no illusions that this will be an easy process. Once again, it will be hard. Healthcare is complicated stuff.
Steve, what do you hear there?
I hear the truth.
That it's complicated.
It is complicated, and I think folks know that. And I do actually think that the president knew that it was complicated, too. He also had visiting with him the CEOs of the insurance companies that if there's any place to find out just how complicated it is listening to those individuals.
Okay, say why. Why is that?
Because the insurance industry, for better or for worse, is basically supporting most of the way payment happens and finance in this country. The insurance industry is what makes the United States so different compared to all the other countries that are out there. And that includes the Medicare program, too. I mean, to a certain extent, Medicare is not actually paid for by the government. It's operating through private insurer transactions that the government just happens to pay.
Right.
The folks that showed up at that meeting know all of those intimate details quite well, actually. And
Arkel,
they shared them.
Arkel, what is complicated about it that the GOP and the president may be just discovering?
Well, there's lots of moving parts in how we finance healthcare, and there's three key components that I hope the president is familiar with. There's what benefits are covered, what networks are paid for, how do you underwrite, and how do you manage the health of a population? And beneath all of those four key components are thousands and thousands of details to understand. And they all have to work together to make healthcare sustainable and affordable.
This is part of the key, right? Because when you change one large part about the Affordable Care Act, the ripple effect ripples through another big chunk of the ACA, doesn't it?
That's right. Well, they all have to work together like cogs in a wheel.
And why?
Well, let's take, for example, the issue of denying coverage because of pre-existing illness. If you maintain that provision but don't have the individual mandate, which hopefully, or it was hoped to have guaranteed that individuals, healthy individuals, join the insurance pool, then insurance companies will be insuring individuals who are very sick and not be able to afford it. So eventually it won't be sustainable financially.
Rajiv, this is something I wanted to talk about, the individual mandate and the risk pool. Because as Arkell says, if you don't have enough healthy younger people in that pool, it doesn't balance, right? And yet, if you do away with the individual mandate, then it's voluntary as to whether people want to actually join that pool. And maybe the people that are younger and healthier won't. Is that one of the complications, as you see it, of trying to fix it?
I think that's a real complication. And when you think about the costs associated with, for the younger, healthier people, it's actually, with the new changes that have occurred, it's cheaper for them not to participate.
And pay the fine, right?
It's cheaper to pay the fine than to pay these very high premiums. I mean, at MyMeds, we actually ran into this because we used the individual markets for our employees who are younger and healthier, and their premiums went from $200-$300 to double. And so we had to change our entire plan to make it affordable for them. And these are young, healthy people who don't need to spend $600 a month on their health care just to participate, and it's way cheaper to opt out.
You know, we have some young, healthy people in the audience. Maybe we could get the microphones here. Is there anybody in the audience today? Again, you're graduate students in healthcare, so maybe you don't want to admit this. But is there anybody who'd rather pay the fine and not sign up for healthcare insurance? Or are some of our younger people on their parents' plan here? Is there anybody who's opted out of health insurance? They're all such good Americans here.
They've all taken my class.
Which is required that you have health insurance?
It's required that you at least know about health insurance.
All right. Maybe I should ask it this way. Is there anybody who would weigh in on the value of having to pay these premiums in a time when maybe you don't use a lot of health care? Do you have health insurance?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I'm pretty risk averse.
Okay, so may I ask how old you are? You can give us a range if you want to.
I just turned 30.
Okay, so you're a little bit beyond the being on your parents' coverage.
I am.
But you probably don't go to the doctor that often.
I don't.
Okay, so why is this why do you know that you have to have health insurance when you probably don't use it that much?
Accidents, that's basically the first thought that comes across my mind. I've heard horror stories about people who've been in accidents and who are still paying off their insurance bills. Uh-huh. Not insurance bills. Healthcare bills.
Right. So for you, even if you're having to pay this month to month, mm-hmm. it's worth it.
Absolutely.
Let me go right next door to you right there. How about you? What's your story?
I do have insurance, and I can say that I definitely saw a substantial increase in the monthly premium that I have.
Do you remember what it went from to?
It went from something like around $100 to something like around $300.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah.
That's a lot. Did you start to think, how much do I really need this?
Kind of. It's hard as a graduate student, somebody who has some familiarity with insurance and our medical system, to imagine not having insurance. At least that's how I feel, and I would say a lot of my peers feel. We just live in a country where we know there's always that possibility that you could be hit with a multi-million dollar health bill, and we've seen that be a key way, I believe, that a lot of people move from being middle class to being in poverty.
Good students, Steve. Here, they all have their health insurance. What happens if you do away with the individual mandate, though?
You need to have other incentives that compensate for it. The market operated for a long time without them. We operated in the state of Minnesota just fine without them, as a matter of fact. I think where most of the individual mandate comes from in terms of actual public policy is when it was applied in Massachusetts. And actually sort of in the same idea of starting it out real slow. But at the same time, it's a much smaller state compared to the country. There was actually a much bigger PR push that actually occurred centered in the Boston area. There was a different really a different response. I think the what the Republicans are proposing as a counterweight to the individual mandate is guaranteed renewability, meaning that you have to keep continuous coverage with some gap, maybe up to 2 years. Otherwise, your premiums could have a surcharge if you don't stay in the pool or get yourself into the pool early on. That's just an incentive. I mean, the whole point is to keep people into the
right.
into the pool, and the thought is if we could do it in a reasonable way, that would be okay. I think the individual mandate, for better or for worse, is seen as a tax, and that's how it's portrayed and got highly politicized in the last election cycle.
I want to come back to something you said about Minnesota, and it was all just fine. Arkell, was it? Was it all just fine when people could choose or not to have health insurance in Minnesota?
We saw health insurance premiums increasing nationally, which is the lens I had, in the double digits, and we've seen them come down to the, into the single digits. But that being said, we're seeing health insurance premiums again go back into the double digits. So individual mandate or not, it's not working. We're seeing health insurance premiums.
Can you say why that is? And I know, again, that that is a complex series of issues. But could you tell, you know, American citizens and Minnesotans why it is that they are seeing healthcare costs go up the way they are, and then their premiums reflecting that?
Well, it is very easy to blame greedy insurance companies for rising premiums. And in
fact,
that
feels good, doesn't it?
It does feel good. It's always wonderful to be able to point somewhere else. But in fact, we are the cause. We, all of the people, are the cause of rising health insurance premiums, and not because we're doing anything bad, but these are the facts. For every dollar that is spent for a health insurance premium, 85 cents goes to medical costs. So there is a very simple math equation and a correlation. When medical costs go up, health insurance premiums go up. 85 cents on the dollar. And so as we consume more medical services as a population, as we demand more, as we age more, as our technology expands, we are spending more. And as a result, health insurance premiums are going up.
I want to go to two of the doctors that I know here in the audience and find out what they think about that. Craig, would you weigh in on that?
So I'm Craig Bauer, and I'm a hospitalist and internist here in the Twin Cities. I think at a philosophical level, everybody's for the highest quality, lowest cost healthcare until they get sick. And then they want everybody covered completely at a reasonable cost. And that's not how it works.
Well, other countries manage to do that, don't
they? Well, it's interesting because the conversation has started off about the finance of healthcare. And I've always thought and continue to think that American healthcare is a very expensive restaurant that serves average to slightly above average food. And so we fixate about, well, how do we pay for that bill? The tab is so high, without saying, like, the food doesn't warrant this kind of cost. So I think there are two conversations. And the second one, the quality issue, is harder because quality is very difficult to measure in medical healthcare.
Let me go to Anne. Say who you are and what you practice, if you would.
My name is Anne McIntosh, and I'm an emergency medicine physician. And in the emergency department, it's a unique population that we see. And what I've often said in terms of the cost of healthcare, and I agree wholeheartedly with what Arkell said, is that the focus of the discussion is not on health, it's on healthcare financing. And until we can move to the discussion of health and what's really driving healthcare costs, which to a large degree is the lack of health amongst the American population and the high demand and utilization of healthcare, we're never going to get this changed, because the healthcare financing, in my eyes, is a shell game. And what we really need to do is cut cost.
Don't we have to talk about how to pay for it? I know quality is important and people having universal access to healthcare is important, but don't we? We have to talk about how to pay for it, don't we?
We definitely have to talk about how to pay for it. As a physician that's practiced in the emergency department, where we are mandated by federal law to see everybody who darkens our door, I'm frequently asked people, why'd you come to the emergency department? And they're like, well, because I don't have any money. So certainly, I think, you know, all practicing physicians and everybody who has a job wants to get paid for doing it. So healthcare financing is definitely important. However, health has to be part of the conversation. And the other thing I think that's not addressed is people misplace health insurance with access to health care. And there are two different things. And we don't have access to health care just because you have health insurance, including today. When you have high deductibles, that is a barrier to access. And I think the general population has to understand healthcare, healthcare financing, healthcare access, and all the things that we're talking about to a much larger degree than they do now, which is why I appreciate these programs a lot. But I think we have to really have a basic understanding, everybody, especially the people who pay. And we then need to decide as a society how we're going to move forward, ensuring good health care, better health, and how we're going to pay for those things.
Rajiv, would you say something about that before we go to the next audience?
Yeah, so I'm a nephrologist, so I'm a kidney doctor.
Okay.
And when you think about dialysis, which is life support, people choose to go on dialysis, and then they complain about having to pay for it sometimes. But without it, they would die. And it's a very expensive treatment, and it's a necessary treatment for people. But when you think about ICU care, end-of-life care is very expensive. And one of the things that people in this country are very afraid of is talking about death and recognizing that everybody dies. But the amount of money that's spent in the last, I think it's the last year of life, is infinitely higher than they spend every other time.
You're talking about money again, though. And we've heard from a couple of our physicians here who say this conversation shouldn't be all about money.
It shouldn't always be about money, but there's certain times that we have to think about it. When you think about a 95-year-old person who gets a pacemaker, that doesn't make sense. And we need to think about that. So you can't ignore that. We want to give care to people. We want to give the best care to people. And that's why we all went into the business of medicine, of practicing medicine.
Our ER doc wants to respond. Hang on.
Well, I think that's the perfect launch to where the discussion needs to be. Yes, it's talking about money. But what is the number one reason for people to go on dialysis? Diabetes.
Diabetes, high blood pressure, and not taking care of yourself prior to that moment.
Right. Much of it is preventable. Much of that cost is preventable. And that's, as you know, Carrie, one of my passions is end-of-life care planning. And if we addressed end-of-life care planning, and if we talked about prevention ever, we would address a lot of the spending problems.
Steve, do you think that's right?
Yeah, I do think it's right. We are our own moral hazard as a country. We like to consume healthcare. We actually like to consume entertainment, too. And the only difference between entertainment consumption and healthcare is that, for the most part, healthcare is half publicly financed. Entertainment's only about 10% publicly financed. Depends how we look at stadiums.
Healthcare's life and death. Entertainment, no. Isn't that another difference, Steve,
well,
or no?
The Super Bowl's a life and death thing, Carrie. But that is true. But at the same time, it depends what you're putting protections for. I mean, I think that catastrophic insurance for the country, or giving incentives for catastrophic insurance, is the right floor to have. And then everything else should be cash or some prevention that comes along. And to be honest with you, in terms of a macroeconomic sense, given our preferences as a society, that's about all we can afford.
Wait a minute. I want to make sure I understand this and listeners understand that. You said people should be covered for catastrophic health care. The rest is up to us to pay for it?
Yes.
Yes. Arkell, what do you think of that?
I've been waiting to jump in. I think that I'd like to bridge from the term that Steve just used, catastrophic, to the issue as to why we're always talking about healthcare financing. I think that as a nation and as a population, we are not courageous enough to talk about limiting benefit coverage. We just cannot have the nation and the government support every MRI, every elective procedure, everything. But we're not courageous enough to talk about that.
Well, I noticed you didn't use the word rationing, which is immediately what happens in that conversation, right?
I try to avoid politicized words. But rationing suggests that there's not enough to go around. There's more than enough MRIs to do them on anyone that wants them. The question is who's going to pay for it. And so I think that when the 10 essential benefits were laid out in the Affordable Care Act, the federal government punted to the states and said that there was different health care in Colorado than in Florida because they were too cowardly to say that we have to define this. That's the step that we have got to take. If we don't, we keep talking about financing.
I mean, that's a political discussion, too. Isn't that exactly why there isn't enough courage to have that discussion?
Well,
we don't really
course.
Have a courageous Congress.
Well, that's of course, because our constituents are voting for the people that are passing or not passing a health reform law.
You're listening to a Friday roundtable, and we are having a discussion about health care in the NPR forum. We're taking a look at how the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as Obamacare, works now. And we've invited guests and an audience into the forum to talk about the changes that might lie ahead and some of the changes that our guests and our audience think ought to be made and how we should really be framing this discussion. Dr. Rajiv Shah is with us. He's a physician and he's founder of MyMeds. Steve Parenti is a health policy expert and chair of the Medical Industry Leadership Institute at the U of M. And Dr. Arkel Giorgio is a physician and executive in residence at the Carlson School of Management. I'd like to hear from you as you listen to the conversation. Are you one of those voters, and there are a surprising number of them now, who didn't like the Affordable Care Act? Maybe it motivated your vote on election day. Now you're pretty worried about what's going to happen to Obamacare. Weigh in on Twitter. It's at Kerri, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Okay, back here in the audience, tell me a little bit about yourself.
My name is David White, and I am a graduate of the Carlson School of Business, a full-time MBA program, and had two of our panelists as professors, Arkel and Steve. I'm wondering if the panelists could touch upon something that I think the conversation was trending towards, the role of personal responsibility. When we talk about mandate and choice, on the back end of that is some people make good decisions about their health and some people make less good decisions. I mean, there's lots of reasons underlying those, but I think that's important to touch upon. And then the other is whether healthcare is a right or a privilege. And I think Steve addressed a little bit about, you know, maybe some base level is a right. And then, you know, when we're talking about who gets what procedures and end-of-life planning, is some of that then a privilege?
Two big questions. Rajiv, let me come to you on the personal responsibility, because you brought up dialysis and then we talked about diabetes and managing your own health care. What would you say about that?
Well, I'm a strong believer in personal responsibility from a patient perspective. And so when I talk to my patients and their families, sometimes it's not a comfortable conversation because you have to say, well, what are you doing? And they'll say, well, how did I get here? Well, it's pretty simple. You didn't take your medicines, and if you'd controlled this, you may still get here, but it'd be at a different time frame. And I think that's something that here in this country, it's still an uncomfortable conversation for people to think that I have to have any responsibility for my health care, because people think health care is free. And that's because you get insurance, whether it's government or not. And even if you don't have insurance, if you show up in the ER, you always get taken care of.
I feel like doctors drop the ball on the personal responsibility side of this. And I can hear it in just the way you just described that. I mean, what you really could have said to that proverbial patient is, you ate badly, you're overweight, you smoked. I mean, right? Aren't those the uncomfortable conversations that doctors really don't want to have when it comes to personal responsibility?
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, no one wants to say that to someone because, you know, everyone's
so concerned. Blaming.
Yeah, everyone wants to sound like, you know, you're not blaming somebody. But at the end of the day, personal responsibility matters. And
how much does it matter, though?
Again, it depends on who you talk to. For me, it's a big deal. For my patients, we talk about it. And I say, look, I'll go to the end of the world with you if you come with me. But if you don't care, why should I? And I'll do what I have to do, but I'm not going to go above and beyond because it's not going to matter. And when you say that to people, it sets an expectation. And when you set that expectation with how people think, all of a sudden their behaviors start to change, because I call it expectation theory. If you set a bar, people do their best to either reach it or come pretty damn close. And I think that's something that is really important to me as a physician.
Well, I definitely think personal responsibility is key. The reason why I advocate catastrophic insurance for all is that just to try to actually let people think about the exercise and sort of say, look, up to a certain threshold, it's on you. It's a very hard behavioral lesson to learn. But we're spending a lot of money. We're at a point now where with the premium increases the way we are, it's a very hard ship to turn around. It would have been easier to make a few other changes earlier than where we are. As a thought exercise, but also a reality, everybody is confronting these high deductible health plans. We don't talk about it very much. But it's not just in the ACA. It's right. Happening as a corporate trend across all of America, and that's a much bigger population.
Let's break that down for a second. What you're talking about is most of us get our health insurance through work.
Right.
And our employers, it's less expensive for them to sign on with a high deductible where more of the cost of it falls on us.
Correct.
The employees.
Correct. And some of it was accelerated, actually, by the Affordable Care Act because of the Cadillac tax, basically having the employers wanting to stay below an area. The expectation was that if benefits were too generous, they would then be taxed, and then that money would then pay for the Affordable Care Act. Well, most large employers basically started getting as close to they could to the threshold where they would be taxed, and the only way they can make that work as an insurance product is to have a very high deductible, which has been the fastest growing health insurance design this nation has ever seen.
Arkell, I want to ask you a question before you weigh in on this. Do you see anything in the discussion around the changes being made to the ACA that address this part of our conversation?
The issue of personal responsibility is glaringly absent from the ACA and glaringly absent from any other proposal that's been laid out by the Republicans. And so why is that? Again, for a few reasons. One is that personal responsibility is all about behavior. You really can't regulate or legislate behavior. But two, I think that it's not politically correct. It doesn't get votes. And let's just take one example. Employers are able to provide a 30% discount on the premiums when people participate in wellness programs. Mm-hmm. However, they are not allowed to offer those discounts if based on achievement of certain lifestyle thresholds.
Okay, so give me an example.
So did you lose enough weight that your blood pressure came down to normal?
Right.
Did you lose weight? Did your cholesterol come down to normal? So the only way that the only thing that's legal is to give discounts based on whether you participate or not, not whether or not you achieve the outcome that's important for your health.
What, that's set in law or?
Yes, of course it's set in the law. So why are we so afraid to make people accountable to their health? There's only one aspect of Tom Price's proposal that I am on board with.
Health
HHS
and
Secretary.
I'm Price. Secretary.
Yes.
Now.
And that is that he wants to raise that threshold to 50% of the premium. I agree with that. But what I would add to it to make it even stronger is to allow both participation as well as outcomes to drive whether or not people benefit from it.
Okay. Back out to the audience. Peter, will you introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Peter Bornstein. I'm an infectious diseases consultant in St. Paul. I work at HealthEast and United Hospitals. I manage 7 physicians in our group. As far as personal responsibility goes, I have this conversation all the time with my patients who smoke, who weigh too much, who don't take care of their diabetes. Frankly, by the time they end up on the very expensive end of the healthcare scale, I needed a time machine or a magic wand to fix that problem. I agree, too, about personal responsibility, but at the where you're dealing with the very expensive problems, that ship has already sailed.
Are you responding to me saying that physicians drop the ball? You're saying by the time I see a lot of these patients,
you're spending a lot of money on patients, there's very little you can do about that whole personal responsibility about maintaining your blood sugar, high blood pressure medication, so forth. Those are still important to do. There's still something you have to do. But in terms of expensive things related to dialysis or chronic kidney disease or high blood pressure disease or strokes or chronic infections, I mean, my HIV patients, none of them want to have HIV.
Right.
They all needed to have personal responsibility. But now that I'm spending the money and time and resources to take care of their HIV, I can't go back and change that they have HIV.
Is there anything the ACA can do about that or is that more of a cultural and societal kind of question?
Yeah, so I work with a lot of physicians who are trained in other countries, and they always say, well, in America is the only country where death is optional because there's a perception among patients that I'm not going to die, I don't have to die, I don't want to die. That's not about ACA, though, right? That's
right.
About Medicare for the most part. I mean, ACA is really kind of about bread and butter, everyday people under the age of 65 for the most part. And those people, for them, personal responsibility is appropriate and wellness is appropriate. But those very expensive patients in that group, I mean, where we're really spending all the money, because you're talking about ACA, but you might as well be talking about Medicare. Ask Steve about Medicare,
agreed,
where that train is going, because
right,
that's way more expensive than what you're talking about with the ACA.
Steve, do you want to say something about Medicare?
Yeah, I mean, Medicare is a big gorilla in the room. It is the thing that's eating up most of the entitlements in terms of issues, in terms of why we have so many major debt obligations is because of Medicare. We We are basically debt financing it as it goes. It's basically keeping track of us aging as a population. When we basically approve new medical technologies, the criteria is cost effectiveness, not cost saving. So just from the get-go, you're not necessarily doing anything different that way. And there's one last part about Medicare. It's not, by its design in the original Medicare program, the goal is cure. So many things, when you get to be old, cure's not an option anymore, to Peter's point. And even get to that point of having the conversation of, since cure's not there and you're not immortal, there's really not many places the Medicare program allows in law to take you.
That really surprises me that you're saying that was the framework that it was designed around. Because, well, otherwise, I think of this as a healthcare program for people of a certain age.
And that's how I think of it too. But a lot of times you have to live through these things, in my case, through the eyes of my parents, and I'm managing their end of life care. And right, just even when they needed more home health services or just subacute care for recovery, the home health stuff that was helping, but probably needed a little more time, the goal was, if you're not improving, meaning moving toward cure, it's going to end. And the gaps in terms of going there. And the problem is that by that point, there's just a reality of what you're going to be able to do. In the case of managing my father's own care, he had the sort of, if you will, the very typical American attitude, as Peter's describing it, where he wants to live forever, even at 88. Actually getting him to hospice basically required more or less setting a hospice environment around him by default, just to get him to a safe landing zone, because he would never acknowledge that's where he wanted to go.
Rajiv?
Yeah, so, you know, you were talking about how can we do stuff with the ACA. I mean, I think part of what's happening is, you know, as Arkell just said, if you incentivize people differently, because right now you can be incented to participate in wellness programs, and there's plenty of wellness programs out there, but the outcomes aren't there because we're not incentivizing outcomes. We're incentivizing participation. And we have to think about what ways we can change behaviors. And changing behaviors, you need an incentive to get people going, because we live in that type of world. Then what we have to do is switch from the extrinsic motivators to the intrinsic motivators. And that's where, when you think about healthcare, no one wakes up saying, I want to feel like crap today. They wake up wanting to be healthy. And if you give them the education, the tools, et cetera, it doesn't matter what your socioeconomic background is and whether you've got end-stage kidney disease or you have, you know, nothing yet. I think if you switch the way we're talking to patients, think about incentivizing them differently, and then also thinking about the way doctors interact with patients. We're moving to patients as partners rather than doctor knows best.
But when I hear you say that it doesn't matter what your socioeconomic background is, that makes logical sense, but it doesn't strike me as making real sense. If you live somewhere where you don't have access to the kind of good food that you need to maintain a certain weight so you won't be diabetic in your later years, or you're surrounded by secondhand smoke, socioeconomic does matter, doesn't it?
It does matter. I mean, I trained at Hennepin, and so I spent 5 years there working with, some might say, as the lower socioeconomic class, but the attitude of empowering people,
uh-huh,
setting expectations and letting them know you're not a charity case, you're a person, that changes behavior. So yeah, they might not be able to buy the best foods, but you got to manage around some of that. There's certain things you just expect. All right, this is what it is. We're not going to be able to change that. Not everyone gets to go to Whole Foods. That's fine. Now let's look at what can we do, portion control, walking, exercise, different things that are free. We can do things like that. And we did it at Hennepin, and Hennepin's moving in really good direction.
I think our ER doc wants to weigh in on that right over there. Anne?
Yes. Well, I think what people are pointing out is, again, the elephant or gorilla in the room, in that we don't talk about prevention for a lot of different reasons, and it's not politically correct. The whole conversation's been overly politicized. And I think the reality is, one of the big things we're missing is healthcare consumer, which I mean all of our society, education and empowerment. That's not a part of any of this either. How do you prevent things? How do you treat them? What are our goals for health? What I see happening now, when I talk to people about healthcare and healthcare consumer education, is we're basically throwing the keys to somebody and saying, here, we're not giving them driver's lessons. We're not giving them a map. We're not pointing them in a direction, doing the same thing over and over, expecting something's going to change. We all know that doesn't happen.
I'd really like to hear from some of the, from you guys who are going into public health, right? Most of you, or some kind of healthcare field? Yes, sir. Right on the end there.
Hi, my name's Danny Plooster. I'm a full-time MBA student.
Okay.
So my question is, isn't the time machine prevention? And with the CMS direction for more dollars tied to value, how does that fit into this equation?
Arkell?
I'm going to be media savvy for a second and then switch the question to the one I want to answer, which is that...
What?
I can... Sorry, Danny. But I think that we're naive in thinking that educating adults about how to be healthy is going to have an impact. How we behave is ingrained in us during our formative years. And so we have this naive sense that some level of financial incentive, some sort of regulation or mandate is going to change how we view prevention, taking care of ourselves. Why don't we think about educating our children from, just like we educate around English and science and math and social studies, why aren't we educating children during their formative years about how to take care of themselves, how to navigate the system, how to be empowered consumers? And then I think we can get to the point where we can start discussing and be effective at programs like paying for value instead of volume.
But I mean, that is prevention, right? Just shifting the idea of prevention to a much younger age.
Yeah. And I think that the question is, how do you tie dollars to the programs that you're talking about then?
Those programs don't exist. We teach eighth grade children about sex ed and using condoms and birth control, but we don't teach them anything about how to take care of themselves, how to navigate the system, what insurance costs. We don't teach them any of those things.
You're listening to a Friday roundtable. We are in the NPR Forum. We were having a conversation about health care, the Affordable Care Act, the frame, and the lack of what I guess expertise that so often accompanies this conversation around the ACA, especially when it comes to the political side of the conversation. Steve Parente with us from the U of M, Dr. Arkell Georgiou with us from the Carlson School of Management, and Dr. Rajiv Shah, a physician and founder of MyMeds. You're listening to an edited version of the forum, but you can hear the whole thing on my podcast. Search NPR News with Carrie Miller wherever you get your podcasts. Well worth listening to the whole thing. Okay, other questions here from our grad students. Yes, ma'am.
Hi, yeah, I'm Rebecca Blumenschein. I'm a MBA student at the Carlson School, and I also did a public policy degree. So I'm not a medical health expert, but I'm very interested in the conversation. And I was just wondering, I'd like to ask the panelists, while we're talking about personal responsibility, I'm surprised that the idea, maybe it's too political, but the single-payer healthcare idea hasn't sort of come into the mix. Because as I think about incentives, as we talk about who would be incentivized to teach our children or teach our community the types of things that we're talking about around personal responsibility, how do we think about who that would be? I know that there's unique situations in our country that make the single-payer option less feasible, and I'd like to hear a little bit about that.
Rebecca, if we were doing this with phone calls coming in, it would have been like the first or second call. Single-payer comes up all the time. Steve, why not single-payer?
Well, we just need to have an extra $30 trillion over 10 years, and we'd be fine, but based on the way the current system operates. So if we had a time machine is very popular in this discussion. So if we had one, the time to really set the U.S. to have a single payer system would have been right after World War II. It's probably the most likely time it would have occurred. The biggest reason why, this is documented in Paul Starr's book, Social Transformation of American Medicine, my students are required to read it, basically is the American Medical Association, among others, shut it down. Now, granted, the AMA is not so much, you know, opposed to ACA, and things have moved on since then. But we have a very dynamic history in this country of why we don't have single payer. It's not a new topic. It's a 100-year arc. The first presidential candidate to propose it was Theodore Roosevelt, running as a Bull Moose candidate in 1910. He lost, by the way, 1912, I should say, to Woodrow Wilson, who opposed it and later embraced it once he had a stroke. So I think the idea of getting there is interesting as a thought experiment, but we are a very complex, dynamic country. I think if it was a case of Minnesota opting for single payer, we would have been there probably 70 years ago and followed most of our Scandinavian ancestors or German ancestors, depending on how you want to count it.
But are you saying that that ship has sailed? There's no going back because it would cost too much?
I think the only way it ever occurs is basically a devastating event that more or less has the nation rally around something to respond in an emergency situation, the type of things where people
like
look on the ground.
A pandemic,
zombie apocalypse, whatever you want to think of it.
Yeah.
But something where you basically look at assets on the ground with a military planner's mind and sort of say, where can we deploy quickly for an emergency situation? That's called the Veterans Administration, by the way. And then you turn it over to civilians and you see what happens. That's, by the way, the VA is essentially our closest equivalent for single payer, like a national health service in the UK, except for just veterans. It's organized in a very similar regional fashion. So we know, actually, as a country, how to do this. We elect as consumers to not embrace it, to take it all the way through political office.
Well, and Medicare, Medicare is a single-payer system, not doing very well financially, needs to have reform. So do we want to take a system that is failing and then expand it without addressing the root causes? And I think that that's one of the key reasons why we should at least hold off until thinking about a single-payer system, because it's not going to work.
Other questions from the grad students in the audience right there in the front?
Hi, so my name is Alex Fung. I'm actually a medical student as well as MBA candidate.
Excellent.
At the University of Minnesota.
Wow.
So
you're going to medical school and getting your MBA simultaneously?
I am, yes.
Jeez. So, surprised you have time to be here, but
well,
welcome.
Thank you, Carrie. I appreciate it. So my question, sort of in relation to the four legs of insurance we had talked about, which was network management, underwriting, forgot the other two.
Benefits and medical management.
Thank you, Arkell. So
we're always teaching.
And so the discussion has been revolved around this idea of like personal responsibility and how it may not be maybe politically viable to initiate sort of regulation around that. My question to the panelists is this something where you feel like maybe from the insurance side would be a way either through value-based benefits in which is that viable on the side of the insurance companies to initiate that on their end?
Rajiv, would you weigh in on that?
I can. I'll try. I don't know much about insurance. I'll be the first to admit that, because on the practicing side, we know people either have insurance or don't, and that's about it. I think value-based payments are a good idea, but they're such a small percentage of what's really happening that most people just aren't paying much attention to it in the practical world. I think in the theoretical world, at the health systems, they're talking about it. But again, it's such a small part of it. I am a believer of performance-based metrics in healthcare. And I think that it shouldn't just be on the doctor, though, because you look at primary care doctors and they have to say, you know, they get dinged if someone's a smoker. Well, you can talk and talk and talk, but you may not be able to change that behavior. And why should you, the practicing physician, get penalized for that. That doesn't make sense to me.
When you say dinged or penalized, you mean reimbursement levels, don't you?
I don't think it's reimbursement. I think it's at the
How do you get dinged then?
I think that they, you know, again, I'm in private practice, so I don't know how the hospital systems work, but from what I hear from other doctors, it's, you know, they have a salary, then they can hit bonuses,
okay,
and based on these performance metrics, and they may not hit their bonuses because of it. And I see it in the dialysis units where the dialysis nurses and techs, et cetera, there are certain metrics they have to make. And if they don't, they don't achieve them. And some of them are just, they don't make any sense to me because clinically it's impossible to achieve some of this stuff.
Alex, you brought up the fact, the possibility of incentives, financial incentives, value-based pricing, and personal responsibility. And while theoretically that's a great idea, practically, it would be extremely difficult to implement. And here's why. When we pay doctors based on performance-based measures, it's based on their population of patients. But when we're talking about paying an individual based on their behavior, frankly, there's a really easy practical reason why we can't do that. It's that the claim systems aren't smart enough and programmed in a way that they can administer claims payment based on those criteria. I saw so many great ideas at United Health Group, where I was for 15 years, come up that we simply could not administer because the claim systems aren't wired to do that.
There is more pressure, isn't there, today on physicians to have the kind of outcomes that can be assessed as working, right? I mean, and isn't that pressure only going to increase?
The pressure is only going to increase, and there's even separate laws for it. The doc fix for physicians in Medicare were reimbursed differently is now have a new rule called MACRA that more or less puts even more of these value-based components in. I am skeptical about a lot of these things. This also goes along with accountable care organizations because one of the other courses I teach is health information technology. I welcome the moment where I can change my PowerPoint slides for the first time in 20 years. They're all basically talking about, in the future, we will have this great system. A lot of money has gone into trying to get us to a new level. To Arkell's point about the claim systems, the claim systems could be retrofitted, almost like a dumb bomb, being with a sled to make it a smarter weapon. But it requires Medicare or the insurers to make massive investments, and they're both looking at each other with a game of chicken to figure out who's going to do this. So to Alex, to answer your question, insurers could do this, but they're waiting for who's going to go first. And in the meantime, in terms of figuring out value-based, you need to figure out there's a cost element of that too. We don't want to always admit it, but there is. And that means that the hospitals themselves and delivery systems have to have managerial accounting systems that actually conform to accounting principles that we teach in MBA schools. And right now, we can't do unit costing to figure out what the value is for the dollar in any detailed sense that could actually operationalize all these ideas.
I wanted to come back to Alex just as a medical school student and an MBA student. Tell me how you're going to use those two disciplines.
Oh, for myself?
Yeah, I'm just interested in how you may play a role in solving some of this stuff we're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely.
About.
This is
all on you.
Right, and so this is my bread and butter interest. I've been involved in healthcare policy from the organized medicine side of it. I've been involved with the MMA as well as AMA in regards to our policy council as well as our political action committee. My hope is that in the future to also not only so drive some of the policies that we develop, but to potentially also sort of help run some of these health systems for better practices and workflows, and also on the side of medical devices and research, which
is... So when you hear this discussion, you hear what Steve just said about we've been talking about the future for years. I mean, how optimistic are you that the time is coming when some of the best practices on this can be put into effect when we see so many obstacles to that?
You know, and I think part of it is that as a medical student and just as a student in general, I'm very idealistic. I believe that, although there's a lot of talk on evidence-based medicine as well as, talk as well as compassion for our patients and our training, there's more sort of curriculum and education around how physicians can inspire but not necessarily penalize patients, but to inspire them to take on this personal responsibility. Because like you said, part of it comes down to, it may not be from a policy regulatory standpoint, but maybe a conversation that we have in the patient room. And really that comes down to this idea of, as a physician, do I feel like I have time to really engage in this kind of conversation with compassion and with empathy, and not think any less of someone, but that everyone deserves, that kind of care.
Let me go back to Dr. Craig Bowern over here just for a second. Craig, what do you think about what Alex just said?
Well, I spend a lot of time educating my patients, but I'm also, I think most of this is about behavior. And to be truthful, I'm a very expensive life coach, very expensive and highly overtrained.
As a hospitalist.
Yeah. Do we want to pay our physicians to be life coaches? Because most of the time, I can't tell you if I've ever seen a patient in a room and said, like, you know what? You're grossly overweight. There's two of you when there should be one. And nobody ever says, you're not, are you kidding me? I'm overweight. I didn't know. Or I say, this smoking is the reason you came back in to reopen the leg artery that we opened 6 months ago. You don't say. So there's nobody who's surprised by these things. None of my patients are surprised. Everyone's been educated. It's just about, like Paul said in the New Testament, it's about doing the things I know I'm supposed to do and I can't.
Rajiv?
Yeah, so one thing about that is, this whole conversation is about patient and physician. And I think what we forget, there's other people in this team. This healthcare team includes nurses, pharmacists, health coaches, family caregivers. That's the difference. We can't expect that the physician's going to do all this stuff. You know, with this MACRA thing, I mean, the amount of typing that we have to do is ridiculous. And I know how to type. In my practice, you know, we haven't hired scribes yet, but we're actually thinking about that. I feel like that's the fastest growing part of healthcare is medical scribes because the older doctors can't type. And it takes a really long time. I mean, I can type.
Wait a minute. Are you telling me this whole ball of wax boils down to doctors can't type? So
a lot of the job dissatisfaction of doctors is the fact that when you see a patient, you're typing, you're not looking at them. Patients don't like that. And you're losing that connection. But when you think about that as the expensive life coach, there are other people who are involved in this. We haven't even talked about the cost of medications and that contribution to the problems in healthcare. But it's, if you're going to, I mean, at my meds, we're all about adherence. Adherence is the biggest problem in healthcare.
Taking your medicine when you should.
$300 billion a year is wasted due to this problem.
God, wow.
And it's not the doctor who's going to solve this problem. It's the pharmacist. It's the family caregiver. It's other people on that team working together. And I think that's the future of healthcare, is the team-based approach. And that's where the new doctors, you know, you might be in med school and idealistic. I'm 10 years out and I'm still idealistic. But it's also because I see it changing. When you look at the generational change that's going to happen, it's all now about multidisciplinary. It's about understanding there's the patient who has to be in the middle, and let's build around that person to really do it. And I think that's the future of where things are going to go.
Steve, that sounds expensive on the front end, not necessarily on the back end. It's kind of how Mayo does it, isn't it?
It is how Mayo does it. And it's actually how a lot of integrated delivery systems do it. And part of it is they have storied histories in how they've learned to do it very efficiently. And that's why they're very good at what they do.
Is it true that it's expensive on the front end, but cost effective on the back end or not?
Mayo's motto, and it's actually more of an engineering motto, fix it once, fix it for life. You know, but the issue is that if the thing that you're fixing is the fact that you can't control yourself behaviorally in terms of how you're taking care of yourself, there's only so much you can do, which is a lot of what this conversation is. There's a lot of folks at Mayo that are in that boat as well.
But these people already exist. We already employ pharmacists. We already employ nurses and techs and this. It's just a matter of redirecting. And I think that's where it doesn't have to be more expensive. It's just more efficient.
Arkell?
Well, this is some of the new thinking that I would love to see evolve in whatever we bring into this new health reform law, which is that, you know, in our country today, we have a very narrow definition of care and what gets reimbursed for care. We reimburse licensed professionals who deliver care in regulated entities like hospitals and pharmacies for CPT code worthy procedures. But let's think more broadly about how much larger this care community could be. What about families and communities? What about software tools and games and applications that can contribute to people getting better? What about hotel care? There are so many broader ways that we could bring efficient care, but we're stuck in thinking about the same old things in all the regulation that's being designed. There are many creative ways to design a better system.
And by PS, the ACA doesn't really address any of this.
Not at all.
No.
Great. Yes, sir.
Hi, my name is Caleb Murphy. I'm also an MD-MBA student. And my question is dialing back into the next 2 to 4 years of health policy discussions. There was a notable interaction. It was short, but I think it was notable during Secretary Price's confirmation hearing. And I think it was with Bernie Sanders, where Bernie asked Tom Price if he believed that healthcare was a right. And Tom Price basically hedged. And to me, that signals potentially a culture shift, that there's an expectation of a right to healthcare now, potentially. Number one, do you think that's the case? And number two, how do you think that will impact Republican health policy efforts in the next 2 to 4 years?
This is good. I'm glad David asked that and I forgot about that. And I'm glad you're bringing us back to that. Healthcare or right? Arkell, grab onto that first, if you would.
I think that being the most sophisticated country in the world, we deserve to give all Americans access to what Steve called catastrophic care. I will say a basic set of benefits that is different than the essential benefits. So I do think that for unexpected events, it is a right. But
I would define that and create a floor around that.
Caleb, I'm curious about how that sounds to you, actually, as somebody, again, you're in med school and an MBA. You'll be in this field soon.
Yeah, I mean,
does that sound fair?
I think that's reasonable. Essentially, it sounds like you're saying it should be a conditional right, the way that education is, for example. If we have the funds to pay for it, we should expect to provide something for people.
Is that what you're saying, Arkell?
Yes, but Steve called it catastrophic. You know, insurance is for unpredictable events, and it is meant to prevent a financial catastrophe. That is what insurance is for. I think we should provide that for all Americans.
What happens if I'm a patient of Rajiv's and I have catastrophic care insurance, but that doesn't cover my needed dialysis? Too bad?
But it would. I mean...
It would?
That's correct.
ESRD is covered no matter what your age. End-stage renal disease is covered no matter what. That's the part of the Medicare program. I mean, selectively, what the U.S. has done is for different condition-specific areas, healthcare is a right. So the EMTALA law that Anne mentioned before, any one of us can walk into a hospital basically bleeding and be treated. So that was one of the myths that sort of sold ACA that I'm going to die on the floor. No, not because there was a law passed in the 70s that basically addressed that fear.
But that's exactly what I think of as catastrophic. So I'm trying to figure out where the line is.
I think in my mind, I actually go back to President Roosevelt and Winston Churchill when they formed the Atlantic Charter, which was basically the basis for most of health policy that we know of today in the post-World War II world. And their statement was, we want to live in a world that's basically without fear and want. And when I think of catastrophic and I hear about people buying insurance, some of the students' comments, that's fear. The fear of that unknown, massive thing that will bankrupt you. It's not necessarily, I need to get oral contraceptives. It's not all the extra stuff that comes into the benefit design.
Mm-hmm.
So if we're going to establish a floor that even adheres to one of the most ardent Democrats in the country's history that advanced a whole bunch of social policy, let's start there. And then we can figure out as a society, based on our own individual wealth, what we can afford on top of that.
So we're not going to cover birth control in the new world order. Is that right?
If it's generic, maybe. I mean, it depends. I mean, there's a question about, to
be
fair about this.
That sounds somewhat catastrophic to me.
To be fair, I mean, what catastrophic is a very hard drug to take to sort of learn about behavior. And so, but it works. And I do find in my own research in consumer-driven health plans is that there's almost like a Kubler-Ross process of loss and acceptance when people have these plans where it's sort of, you know, denial, anger, the whole thing. But yeah. What happens is that folks do sort of talk to each other about, well, now that I have to face $6,000, and this is assuming they're not super sick.
Yeah.
You know, where do I navigate? What drugs might be cheaper if I didn't have to think about this before? Do I really need to get the knee replacement now? Why am I even getting the knee replacement? Maybe if I lose a bunch of weight, I don't need the knee replacement or the pain is somewhat less. I mean, it's a hard lesson, but it is in terms of just underwriting one that works.
I'm trying to think of maybe somebody in the audience can think of the gray area that isn't so obvious, that it isn't catastrophic life and death, but yes, ma'am. Right. That you thought of it. Great.
A potential option for consideration.
Okay.
One of the life events that a lot of us females at least would go through is childbirth.
There you
it's
go.
Very expensive to the healthcare system.
Right.
In my case in particular, I'm fortunate enough to work at a company that has very good health insurance. And when my twins were born a year and a half ago, almost 3 months early, it would have cost if I took the straight unreduced cost about $1.2 million ish.
Wow.
And that was with very, very few complications, just like a little infection here or there. So I was very lucky. They were in the hospital for about 2.5 months and they came home. Well, one was on oxygen for a month at home, but then they were great. Couple home health visits to check in and you're on your way. That's the kind of thing that I'm a very healthy person. I still had insurance. We knew that kind of thing is coming down the pipe. You can plan, kind of, for childbirth. It's not catastrophic in most cases. So where do you draw the line on if you had to urgently go, well, I suppose what delivery isn't urgent, but where do you draw the line on whether it's catastrophic or not?
It's a great scenario for this, Steve.
If you had a high deductible health policy, you would pay $10,000 probably out of pocket and the rest would be covered.
Okay.
What if you don't have insurance?
Then you're going to be in medical bankruptcy court and you're going to be settling through assets in terms of where things go forward. This is again, why I'm pointing. There's a lot of reasons why this high deductible health policies are helpful. For one thing, you get negotiated rates. If you actually are uninsured and a major event actually occurs, you will be paying 10 times, or at least bill collectors will be coming to a factor of 10 times higher, mostly because the probability that a hospital will ever collect that money from you is 10%. It's a pretty direct ratio. And they will hound you, and then in the end, they'll work a settlement out basically at that rate that would have been negotiated had you had the catastrophic plan to begin with.
Steve, I think you were on the last show that I did where we talked about high deductible plans, and the phone lines nearly caught fire. People are so angry about the high deductibles that they have to pay that they're not using their health insurance. They're not using their health care. How does that solve the issue?
It is not a perfect solution. It's a question of all of the evils that we're looking at, it's probably the least helpful, the most helpful in terms of trend, in terms of keeping healthcare costs down and forcing the consumer that otherwise doesn't want to look in the mirror about how healthcare spend goes. I mean, if you go to other economies around the world, India, for example, we look to India because their healthcare costs for CABG procedures are a fraction of ours. India's system is largely cash. So if you want to know what the actual markup that occurs from a wealthy society, because we have an employer-based system where we are very comprehensive in our coverage, it's a multiple of 300%.
And most of these costs of healthcare are fake anyway. I mean, the $1.2 million, as you said, is their rack rate. Who pays rack rate? And everything's negotiated down. And so when we have patients who don't have insurance, their bill comes out with a crazy number.
Do you know how infuriating that? I know exactly what you're saying, that nobody would pay.
No.
Nobody would really pay. But that is infuriating to the healthcare consumer.
Well, in our practice, we have a rack rate. And if someone doesn't have insurance, there's a reason they don't have insurance. It's not that they're just made out of money and they don't need it, because they all have insurance. It's people who don't have insurance generally don't have money.
Why do we have a rack rate? Why don't we just have the real rate?
Because it's the insurance companies, right? So at Blue Cross, for example, there might be 10 different rates based on the 10 different plans, and it's all different negotiations. So you want to make sure that you're charging at least as much as the highest reimbursable amount, and then you write off everything else.
Yeah.
But the fact is that if they don't have insurance, in our office, we just cut that right away. First I ask, what can you afford? And if they can't afford anything, we just make it free, whatever we can. But we cut everything right away, because if you're cash pay, it's because you don't have insurance. So rather than you getting some ridiculous bill that makes no sense and you're never going to collect anyway, let's give them something that actually makes sense to them.
Steve, you were going to say?
No, I'll pass.
Well, just to answer the question of why is there a rack rate, the reason that there's a rack rate, another reason, is that when an insurance company contracts with a physician or a facility, they know that they're going to get about a 56% discount on that rack rate. So if you lower your rack rate, then you're going to get you're going to be asked to give a 56% discount off of that. Now you're at 25%. Of what reimbursement you would like. So the rack rate is so that you can maintain a level of reimbursement that would allow your practice or facility to operate.
I know in healthcare finance that makes sense. It makes no sense to the average patient.
I mean, it's being done in a way to basically keep hospitals solvent and to keep the provider community solvent, given the issues in terms of collections.
Yes.
I mean, that's why this grew up this way.
There are people that will pay more because there are a lot of people who cannot pay. I know that's super simplistic.
There is a huge spectrum of pricing, even in drugs. I mean, we have one of my former students went on to become VP at Target when they had their Target pharmacy. He had literally 3.5 separate rules for a set of 20,000 drugs that essentially Target had available in their pharmacy. And they would vary month to month, not just one price for one drug.
Right.
Even if you said there's five different insurance types, that's still not 3.5 million. What I really admire about what we're doing right now is we are having a conversation, to be quite honest. I was just in D.C. yesterday. That does not happen. To be this honest and candid, and to Arkell's point, it should be part of American civics today to learn about this. If it's 1/6 of our economy, if it's the biggest reason why this country will go bankrupt, to not have it be discussed is honestly not part of what a civilized society should do.
We have time for a couple more questions and comments. Peter.
So we talked about, high-deductible health plans and catastrophic care, but that works great for an episode of care like a pregnancy. But if you have a mental health condition or if you have multiple sclerosis where you have to be on, you may be diagnosed in your 20s and have to be on expensive medications for years and years, those don't work out so well because you're going to be spending $10,000 a year every year. And maybe you go into a high-risk pool, MCHO we used to have in Minnesota, but then you're relying on the state to finance that to the extent that you can still be covered. That's where the ACA has been a godsend. For a lot of these people who have chronic conditions, personal responsibility doesn't matter when you have multiple sclerosis. That disease doesn't care that you watch your weight or you don't smoke. So how you handle that kind of condition, that's where the ACA has really helped a lot of people who have these chronic conditions.
Good question. Arkell?
Well, and all of the proposals that I have reviewed, we'll see what comes out with this Republican administration, is that there would be a provision of continuous enrollment, but pre-existing conditions could not be a reason to deny care. So we would still maintain insurance for those individuals. Steve, am I correct? You're more familiar with these things than I am.
Yeah, but I think what Peter's getting at is, like, what do you do for the folks that are in there right now? I mean, one thing, I want to put a addendum to my, you know, before your phones light up again about catastrophic insurance. In my world, if you could make a better plan design, it would be to cover, have a high deductible health plan with primary prevention, which is the general prevention, go for physical exams, but also secondary prevention, which has been advocated by the developers of value-based insurance design, Mark Fendrick and Mike Chernu. And that would be for not everyone, but folks that have a chronic condition. There would be drugs and even limited visits available that are basically covered at no cost or very low cost to make sure they don't go off the rails.
So just so I understand, the secondary prevention would be care
given that you had a major condition.
Okay.
And it's the idea is that we acknowledge that you have diabetes, but there's plenty of diabetics that are doing quite well. And the thought is, let's keep them well, make sure they get their insulin, make sure they can see an endocrinologist. And if you do that, that's actually not that expensive. When we did back the envelope calculations, or actually pretty serious calculations, it's only about 5 or 6% more premium to be added in. It's very affordable to add that in as a high deductible health plan design.
Peter?
Well, continuous coverage makes sense. But I think you had Dan Ariely on recently.
Behavioral economist.
And he said, often people are irrational.
Exactly.
And they don't always do the continuous coverage. Or life is what happens when you're making other plans. And, you know, you may lose your job or you may move or you have to go to another state because your parent is dying. And so, yeah, continuous coverage makes sense, but there's still going to be people, and I suspect a significant number of people, for whom that doesn't work.
Just a quick, the continuous coverage, the way some of the Republicans are proposing it, depends on the proposals that are there. Some of them are actually using some of the things from ACA that are auto-enrollment. In other words, if you're in the plan and you're getting some sort of subsidy, the thought is you'll be enrolled the following year, and then it's up to you to opt out. So that way, that should, at least if there's a concern about care continuity, that might be lessened.
We have time for one more remark here. Yes, Alex, okay. Go ahead.
I guess sure. That'll be me. So I guess pertinent to this discussion, we talked about increasing premiums and sort of corrections in the market. I would wanted to see if the panelists were able to elaborate any more on this idea of the death spiral in relation to the individual mandate community rations and guaranteed issuance.
Can somebody please translate whatever that meant?
Oh, yeah. So the individual mandate we talked about before, so you have an incentive to buy.
Yes.
Guaranteed issue just simply means that if you are applying for insurance, you won't be turned down.
Okay.
You might not like the price, but you won't be turned down. And then the issue about the spiraling premiums, as we know, premiums are going up and up. So the where all these things come together is that if, in effect, the premiums go up and then the younger folks stop day out, the mandate isn't enough, that potentially sets up this sort of death spiral situation, which basically means that insurance gets unaffordable. What that means in reality is, in our state, when insurers suddenly say, and we won't name, say, we're not going to offer in certain markets anymore, and they pull out completely,
Blue Cross.
Like Blue Cross, but actually go to a different state, Pennsylvania, where I grew up. In Philadelphia County in Pennsylvania, there is one, only one plan left in the marketplaces. Here we at least have three in the metro area. And if that, and in Arizona, there's several that aren't anything there at all. So that's suggestive that this is a major concern. That, I think, when the president met with the insurance executives was a major issue of topic. The term they're using is stabilization, and the energy is being poured on making sure that 2018 is survivable as an insurance event year so that the actual insurers in the market are still here. I don't think many people did not predict in the Minnesota market how many folks would pull back.
Right.
You know, they're not there as charities. They are nonprofits, mind you, by law, but they're not there as charities. And to basically be able to sustain a market in that space, they need to know that they won't necessarily lose a lot of money. One meeting I was in yesterday with Aetna, they said that just in the last year alone, they lost basically $450 million.
Can I ask you if they did the right calculations, the honest calculations? Were they under-predicting because they wanted to offer plans and potentially be more competitive?
Minnesota did that. And Minnesota actually, unfortunately, has a reputation because that one plan that did that in 2014 is basically not being very savvy. We started to think of ourselves as being above average. That wasn't a really above average moment for us. In other states, the issue is there. And I think if there's a fault, ACA is too complicated in terms of figuring out where the premiums are. I remember working with some of the folks in the administration, the Obama administration, actually, before ACA was implemented, and they did a test working with insurance executives, the actuaries, and everyone else. It's almost like a war game simulation to see how they would react. Almost every plan, major plans, failed. The actuaries' instincts were the exact opposite of what the regulations were telling them to do. And unfortunately, that's what we watched the whole thing unfold as it continues to go. And once you actually take on that level of loss, it's and have that loss of confidence, just like in life in general, it's hard to come back and suggest you want to stay in that market.
Let me close this with just a question to Arkell and Rajiv here. Do you have, what's your level of confidence that the quote-unquote fixes that you've been hearing about for the Affordable Care Act will address much of what we've been talking about today? Arkell?
Well, I think that there will be fixes that will stabilize the market. But I don't think that the conversations are occurring that will address many of the good ideas that came up here today, which would further improve and repair and advance providing people in the entire country with affordable access to health care.
When you say stabilize it, what do you mean?
I think that there will be new regulations put in place, whether you call it repeal, replace, you know, whatever you call it, retain. I think that there will be new provisions put in place so that we get healthier, younger people into the pool.
Okay.
And that in and of itself, I think, will stabilize premiums to keep health insurance affordable.
So the ACA will bump along looking pretty much as it does today?
I think that there will be a lot of changes, but I think that we'll see health insurance premiums remain affordable.
What do you think, Rajiv?
I kind of agree. I mean, I think that, you know, everyone's so concerned about the name because it's Obamacare. When you think about some of these important provisions of pre-existing conditions, mm-hmm. keeping people on the plan until they're 26, things like that, I don't think they're going to change any of that. And I think the idea of we're going to change everything on day one and now all of a sudden it's unbelievably complex makes everyone understand that there's parts of this that are really good. And I don't think anyone's opposed to keeping the good stuff. The parts that they change, everyone's really concerned. But in the end, just like anything political, nothing really changes that much. And that's really how I think it's going to play out.
And on that optimistic note, thank you all. Thank you for being here. Great questions from the audience. Thank you. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much.